Excuse me. Hey, boys. Yeah, you. Yeah. Got something to say? Share it with the whole class.
Okay, welcome to the second episode of The Back of the Class, a guide to education from the kids at the back of the class. To start things off, I'd like to, first of all, thank those people who have decided to follow us so far. We can be found on iTunes by searching for The Back of the Class, and we can also be reached via email at thebackoftheclass@yahoo.com. All of that is one word, The Back of the Class. With me today, I'm Patrick O'Shea, an independent educational technology consultant. With me is Simon Richmond, the chief of party at Tukwere Radio Education in Malawi, and Daniel Curry Corcoran, who is the director of accountability at Newport News Public Schools. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Simon, who will give us the show topic for tonight.
Well, the topic for tonight comes from a newspaper article just published this weekend in the Globe and Mail. Newspaper coming out of Canada, and it is discussing a new state-of-the-art multi-million dollar Inuit cultural school. This school is going to be called, and as a Canadian I have to make sure I pronounce this correctly, Pikasilirivik. Now this is way up north in the territory known as Nunavik, and it's described in the article as a place where Inuit from across the territory can gather to preserve and strengthen their culture, tradition, and language. Now, just a few more excerpts from the article. Government officials say that since it will be so radically different from a conventional education institution, it shouldn't even be called a school. Classrooms will instead be called learning studios. Now, a quote from Hugh Lloyd, the project coordinator. Hugh says, "We're trying to avoid the word school because it brings all sorts of very traditional school images from our own experience. This is going to be quite different." Now, the curriculum is still being decided, but people expect a number of different traditional skills, land-based skills, to be taught, ranging from how to build an igloo to using modern and traditional hunting equipment, as well as forecasting weather using clouds, moon, stars, and the sun. The land, Mr. Lloyd says, the land is going to be the principal classroom. Students will be asked to take photographs while out on the land or working on projects, like making sealskin boots, and then contribute them digitally back to the library at the school. Now, a professor of Native Studies, Mr. Peter Kolchilski, says it's important that the new facility isn't modeled on conventional education institutions. Now, part of this is because of the very sensitive history, the dark history that Canada has with forcing Native Indian peoples into religious schools as a means of cultural indoctrination. That was happening in the 60s, and it's now been discarded, but it still brings back a lot of really painful memories for people. So walking away from that model, they're trying to go in another direction with this school. And this is a quote from Professor Kolchilski. He says, "Our schools, our regular schools, teach us passive watching. We learn to live by the clock. We learn to sit down and shut up," he says. "Those are not skills that translate well in the Arctic environment." In other words, he says, we are trying to make sure that there is no separation between the body and the mind. Now, I thought this was a really interesting article, and we could go in a lot of different directions. But just divorcing it from its specifically Canadian context, it brings to mind a lot of questions, very modern questions that apply worldwide. What should a modern classroom look like? Here they are in northern Canada trying to take the classroom right out of the building and out into the field, and trying to avoid a classroom altogether and create a learning studio experience. So I just wanted to see what you guys think. How could we alter the design of classrooms and the learning experience to be more hands-on, as is the case here in Nunavik, or at least not to be hands-on, but to be geared towards a different type of skill set, different from the one, the kind of 18th century industrial revolution factory preparation model that our current system is based on. Any thoughts from you two?
Daniel?
Well, one of the things that I, you know, took from your, what you're saying is, you know, the idea is that they don't want to call it a classroom, or they don't want to call it a school, but, you know, the curriculum is still being ready. I think we get hung up a little bit too much in all this jargon. I think one of the things that we're going to have to get in touch with is that I don't care if we call it a classroom or a learning studio. I think that was it. That's a new one. I like that. I like a learning studio or a learning cottage or whatever it's going to be. I mean, it's still the same thing. This is still an environment where kids are learning, where I think I don't really care what the structure of the classroom looks like now. I mean, I have experience in working in different classrooms. I think, you know, rooms with a lot of natural light do a lot for students and do a lot for teachers. You know, we're dealing a lot now with thinking about audio devices that teachers can wear, like a microphone, to project themselves around the classroom. And I think we get hung up on so much on what the classroom looks like or what equipment's in the classroom that we lose central focus of what is happening in the classroom. I think if we can rechange the direction of what is happening in the classroom, I don't see why we have to have all this technology. It's good. It's positive. But I think the thing that I take away from your article is, you know, sounded like what they want to do in this this center is to teach kids education, but with practical world settings where they can actually apply their skills. I think that's going to be different in lots of different places.
The thing that interests me most about that article is that I'm all for changing the focus of schools. So, you know, I agree with Daniel that it's, you know, changing the nomenclature, the names of things is, you know, neither here nor there if you're not going to change the practice. The question I have about that article is that it seems to want to change the focus of education towards a more practical kind of application of the skills. But the difficulty I have understanding that is how practical is the application of those skills in that setting. It sounds to me as if teaching students in that setting how to be better hunters or better, you know, fire starters or something like that, that may make them more, you know, it may make them more capable of living within that setting.
But exactly.
Will it help them be successful in the larger world? That's kind of a specific thing about that setting. I tend to agree with the concept of changing things to more student-centered and to more curriculum focused on doing rather than seeing or hearing or those kinds of things. But I have big questions about how appropriate it is to teach Inuit students how to be better Inuits rather than, you know, global citizens and information literate and those kinds of things.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, we have this, one of the things I think we need to come to grips with is we have this global community that's emerging, you know. Who's going to say that their particular lifestyle that they've led for thousands of years is going to be here in another 10 years? I mean, our global climate is changing that fast that we're possibly, again, we're calling it a learning studio, but again, we're preparing these students for jobs or skills that won't exist in 20 years or 30 years.
Let me interrupt you there for a second. I didn't read the whole article. You have to be 18 to get into this school. So off the bat, this isn't meant to replace traditional school. It's meant to give a cultural education that is not being taught in the conventional classroom. So
it's Votech.
So this isn't a school at all.
Inuit Votech.
This is a means of sustaining a culture which is dying out.
It's like a cultural community college. Is that what you're saying?
That would be fair to say, yeah. But another point to make here is that although these skills that are being the skills that were mentioned in the article, like making sealskin boots or reading the weather from the clouds, those might not be, you know, useful in the next few hundred years. But there is a component of cultural education which is really focusing on teaching you who you are as a person. And when you have gone through a kind of cultural deracination, like a lot of First Nations people have, where they've been stripped of their identity, they're not going to be able to function with sufficient self-esteem and a concept of who they are at any job, irrespective of how many skills they have. So it's a matter of building up the person by focusing on their history and the values that their community is trying to still promote.
But isn't that the same problem we have now? I mean, I'm speaking as an English teacher now. I mean, in that conversation that I brought up last week with my student Ebony, I mean, you know, one of the things she was concerned about is all we're going to learn about is dead white men, you know? I mean, that's where I have a little problem in that we're kind of setting kids up. We're telling them who they are as individuals. This is who you are. You make sealskin boots, or, you know, as an African-American child, slavery, 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 slavery. I mean, I just think we're walking a fine line by trying to preserve things that why we try to define people pretty narrowly by their past, but because we struggle to really portray, you know, show them what the future is like. And maybe the future doesn't hold that. Maybe they're much different as a people. I mean, I get the idea of having pride in yourself, and I would never say that's not 100% important to a person's life. But, I mean, if you look at – and I'm talking, you know, get a little spark going here and some pretty big generalities. But, I mean, me being a white man in America, I mean, what's my culture? I'm not sure what my culture is. I mean, I'm not Irish. I'm not German. I'm American. And, you know, I struggle every day to say, what is that?
See, but here's the biggest difficulty, I think, is that this whole thing comes down to a matter of balance. We culturally tend to try to teach our next generation based on what we find important, not necessarily what they find important.
That's right.
And so we try to really put the focus on where we've come from, trying to force that onto where other people may have come from. And you get into a lot of difficulties by doing that. I mean, we're going kind of further afield than where this conversation kind of started. But I think that at the end of the day, we just kind of have to have balance in understanding that where we've come from doesn't necessarily define where we have to go. And so if we're talking about being, you know, valuing the Inuit culture, I'm all for that. I really appreciate that. But I don't think we need to kind of force kids down that path. Now, the idea that you go into this as an 18-year-old and it may be something that you value and you've made the choice to go down that path, I'm all for it. But I don't want us as the next, as the last generation, kind of forcing our entire value structure down the throats of kids who don't necessarily feel that same way.
And to even peoples who have historically had no choice.
Right.
And their education. I mean, one of the images I get, I can just see a young man, a young 19-year-old in this Inuit learning program, learning studio, Votech, call it what you will. I mean, I can just see him making his seal skin boots and shoving his $80 Nikes into them, or, you know, putting his iPod in his pocket. I mean, I'm just not sure that – I think that one of the things we do, and I think it's important that we give people choice to define their selves by what they think is important. I mean, from 1999 to 2000, I was working with the Baha'i Faith in the Gambia, and there was a gentleman there who was doing his PhD study in anthropology, and he was doing a really fascinating study on, you know, the traditional role of how men define themselves in these small fishing villages, because with TV, you know, TV was there, and TV was brand new to the country. It was 7-8 years old, so for the first time, young men got to see TV programs, primarily really bad South American soap operas, but still dramatizations of how men should be. And one of the things that I found fascinating was the number of different colored Michael Jordan jerseys you see in the Gambia. I mean, they were pink, they were green, but everybody was wearing 23. So, I mean, I think no matter what we do to try to preserve history so that people can, you know, this is who you are as a people, modern day the world is going to creep into their lives, and they have to find a place for themselves that they feel positive about and that they can be strong participants in.
Right. And I don't want to dwell on this aspect of the article too much, but let me just say this before.
Which we've done, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, Daniel, you started by saying, I think every day what it means to be a white American. And that's obviously what the students, and there's only 21 students who've enrolled in the opening of this school. That's what these guys are thinking about themselves every day. Mm-hmm. And they're going back to try and figure out, this is a voluntary institution, and it's the only means that they have of getting some kind of formal teaching from the elders in their community. This isn't being forced, and it's not a prescription. But I understand that what you guys are saying, everybody has to define themselves and look for meaning in their own lives. But this is an interesting point. I think that traditional education outside the classroom, learning to hunt, for example, teaches a lot of skills which are extremely important in today's modern society. And I'm not just talking about, tracking an elk or sighting something down the barrel of a gun, but as you are crouching in the bushes, you are deciding whether or not to take a shot. I mean, that's a decision-making process. You're weighing a lot of different factors, and coming to a critical decision. When you are sitting there with your finger on the trigger, you are really making an intensely emotional decision. You're deciding whether to give in and shoot early or to, judge the speed of the wind and crouch a little, crawl a little further and take a safer shot but risk scaring the animal. That's an intense cognitive process. I don't think any kind of worksheet or internet search or even intensely designed group volcano construction in fourth grade is going to teach you the amount of complicated decision-making and emotional deferred gratification that you get when you're, looking at a deer down the rifle of a gun.
But we all enjoyed that volcano project.
I never did the volcano project myself.
Because you were educated in Europe.
They don't have volcanoes there, is that what you're saying?
They used to.
So what we have to do here is extract these actual skills which are being taught, the cognitive skills, from the practical ones, which truly may have no real value in the future world. And yet the same basic human processes like decision-making, emotional kind of maturity and introspective thinking, all of these life skills really, critical thinking and communication, those things can happen in a cultural education institution. And that's what really we need in the modern workforce, in addition to 21st century technical skills.
Well, I think we talked about this a bit. I mean, I think we touched on this topic, and I know a lot of these our topics are probably going to be cyclical, which is good. But we talked a little bit about, maybe I spoke about last time a little bit about, some of the divide we have now in our higher institutions of learning and the needs of K-12 teachers, and that, our field is one of the few fields that I can think of, besides lawyers or doctors, where teachers don't have a real practical experience, or, you're kind of taught your subject matter. You're taught algebra, and then you're taught English, or you're taught Shakespeare, and then you have a semester or maybe even a year-long methods course where you design some curriculum or lessons, and then, you might do those lessons with classmates in your school. But, besides, outside of your six to 14 weeks student teaching experience, you don't have a lot of practical, how do you apply algebra to your everyday life? What are some learning experiences you can do there? So if our teachers aren't being trained in that capacity, the thing that I worry about is we can design our classrooms however we want, but how do we move our students from those lower skills, Bloom's taxonomy, recall, knowledge type instruments that are being measured on our state tests across the nation right now, to those higher order thinking skills that, the evaluation, analysis, synthesis, those type of skills that I think you're speaking about, and yeah, using the communication skills and whatnot. That's the pivotal point we're at now in education.
Yeah. And I think that the way the classroom is designed right now, I mean, if you're going to design a chair, if no one had ever made a chair in the history of humankind, and you had the idea to create a structure to sit on, then you would analyze the way the human body bent, and you would, you know, create something that fit the curvature of the back and have something to hang your knees off of, and you would form a structure based on the capacities of the body. Now, somebody sat down one day and invented a school, but did they really look at how the mind works and fit the structure of the school to the way human beings learn? They didn't. I mean, and there's lots of literature on how schools were created. But the learning process, the process that we all go through, is something that happens naturally outside the classroom. It happens between people of different ages. It happens across the curriculum. You're not limited to learning chemistry for 45 minutes one early morning and then biology after that. The subjects mix together. And if we can begin to design the classrooms to take advantage of the natural learning process of the mind and the relationships within the family and the relationship between kids outside on the playground during recess, then we're going to be tapping into a much more powerful learning experience for children because it's going to be happening effortlessly.
See, it's I guess for me, this whole conversation comes back to the fact that it's all well and good to say that you're going to redesign education and no longer call it a school and it'll be a learning, whatever it's called. But how do you – it's very easy to do that kind of innovative thinking when you have 18 students and they all decide they want to be involved. Yeah. How does this happen in, you know, downtown Baltimore? How does it happen in East LA? How does it happen in, you know, China? I don't know how do you make the leap to reinvent education so that it becomes this more kind of skill-oriented, brain-based learning? This is where I take umbrage with what Daniel has said about he doesn't think the technology is necessarily important in that case. I think that's the main way that we'll get to those kinds of individualized learning kind of initiatives where the students are centered or placed at the center of the learning where they are creating the content rather than simply passively accepting it, where they are in charge of their own cognitive connections that they have to make between content areas. Going back to what you said, Simon, yeah, there's lots of skills that you can learn by looking down the sight of a gun and those kinds of things. But those are only important in the larger context if you can transfer them from that setting to something else where it's not an obvious connection. So we've got to figure out how do we set up the schools so that we can facilitate that transfer of knowledge from one diverse set of the content areas and skills to another that may not seem related but are. And so I don't pretend to pose a solution to this. If there was, you know, an easy solution to be had, then it would be out there already, and education wouldn't necessarily be in the difficulties that it is in. But I think that this is the kind of conversation that we have to have if we're going to make meaningful change in education in general.
Well, let me add something. And, you know, of course, I'm speaking as Daniel here. I mean, I work for Newport News Public Schools, but by no way are my opinions reflective of the division. But one of the things that I think we have really going for us now in Newport News is our Career Pathways Initiative. Our Career Pathways Initiative is an initiative that's really built around the idea that from an early age, kids have experience with different career fields, whether that's being a firefighter or an auto mechanic or a librarian or a doctor or a lawyer. But from early on, people are talking to young children, kindergartners, you know, like you always do. What do you want to be in life? You know, kids come in and they do the firefighter hats or they set up by a policeman. But then as kids' education gets going, that all gets lost. We're no longer thinking about, okay, being a firefighter or having some common goal about where we're going. What is the sense of all this? So one of the things that has really been neat is that, and I think it touches on a little bit about what Simon was mentioning about, you know, the family and the community and you know, the old adage that it takes a village, and that kids are able to investigate lots of different opportunities. They're not learning algebra. They are learning, and, you know, their part of education is maybe sitting in an algebra classroom. And I agree with Simon 100%. You know, we have these school structures that were basically to keep kids busy from planting to harvest, you know, and they sat there and they learned how to write and how to do simple addition and, you know, some history. But after that, they harvested and they came back and they did it all again. So, I mean, I think the whole idea of those sitting kids in a classroom and learning these concepts outside of a larger focus on what part do we play in this global community? We're short-sighting kids a little bit here. I mean, so one of the things that this Career Pathways Initiative is really giving kids an opportunity to do is, as they get going from K to 12, to investigate different courses, do some different internships, have some different mentors, go do some informational interviews, and this kind of learning is being guided by their school counselors and their teachers, and within these different pathways. And of course, they're really malleable kids; they're not set anywhere. You know, all kids are still going to take algebra and whatnot. But I think this is giving kids a real exposure to say, okay, this educational experience I'm getting here matters. It means something. It's going to help me get somewhere, and I think that's lacking in our traditional system.
Well, I mean,
I think part of the excuse me, Pat. Part of the problem is that school is too many things to too many people. And Daniel's just given an excellent example. You make school career-focused so that you're training children for the workforce. And a lot of people are going to be really excited by that and want the latest and best skills to be given to their kids. I certainly would. But then you go up to Nunavut, and the people there want the kids to be learning not skills for the workplace but cultural heritage. And that's also a legitimate goal for education.
I agree.
Not everybody is spiritually inclined, but most people in the world are. How come people aren't focusing on spiritual education for their children? That would be hugely important to a large number of people. But you start throwing cultural education, spiritual education, career preparation, babysitting, all these different demands on the school, all falling on the shoulders of the teacher, then obviously things are going to get boiled down to the lowest common denominator, and nobody's going to end up satisfied. And I think that's part of the problem with modern schools, and one of the reasons why homeschools or charter schools or specialized schools are becoming more and more popular, as parents elect to take the process out of the hands of the professionals and do it themselves in a way that they value more.
Yes.
Definitely.
I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think we're seeing more and more of that. I mean, especially now in this age of accountability, that to break out of this mold where, you know, it does boil down to the common denominator. It boils down to your job, often case, can depend, or your success or your evaluation depends on what percentage of kids you get to pass this test. And, I mean, that's a little difficult for a teacher to say, okay, I want to focus on all this cultural heritage. I want to focus on, you know, helping kids with their career pathways, but I need to make sure that they can do this, this, and this. And the only way, the only training that I have, you know, I don't understand teachers. I can see a teacher sitting there saying, I don't understand how if I teach these cognitive skills, these upper Bloom's taxonomy to synthesize an analysis, am I sure that they're going to be able to do this problem? And I don't think they have a lot of confidence. So they give a quick worksheet or two or three or four or five or six. It becomes easy, quick results. They can see what students are learning, what students are not getting concepts. But, you know, I have a six-year-old in the house now. And, you know, I am seeing from when she just ended, and she's going into the second grade, when she just ended school. And, again, she was in a private school, now going into a public school. She's lost so much. Because, you know, a lot of it is just based on, you know, let's work on these letters, let's work on this, that there wasn't a lot of, you know, we were not as involved in the process as we needed to be as parents.
Well, I hate to kind of end it there, but we're reaching the end of our show. And so at this point, I'd like to just kind of go around and have have a series of closing thoughts, whether it's related to this topic or to something else entirely. I'll give each of you 30 seconds or so to come up with something that might encapsulate your thinking for the week. So let's start with Daniel.
Well, one of the things I get excited about is, especially doing this podcast each week, is, I mean, it gives me an opportunity to sit down with two people whose opinion, 95% of the time, I really respect. And so one of the things that I think we need to have more of is people who are not necessarily trained educators, but have a stake in the system, have strong opinions. I mean, again, I think it gets down to the point of, you know, what part are you going to play in this change? How can you be involved? I think we get a tremendous amount from different individuals of different opinions sitting down, talking about education, what is important, what do we want our kids learning, because essentially that's what's going to change our schools. When our parents and are able to go to our schools and say, listen, we know these state tests are important, but we want to see more of this. And, you know, we really appreciate the idea of kids learning about their heritage or learning about their neighborhood and what can we do to make that better. So I think there's powers in numbers. And the more we get people to sit down that have different opinions and come up with, you know, here are some good ideas and get out there and share their ideas, and we're going to get some momentum and things are gradually going to change for the better.
Okay. Simon?
Yeah, I think I just want to encourage parents the world over to try and play a more active role in their local school, because I think parents are obviously the first educator of their children, and particularly mothers, although fathers have an equally vital role. Schools aren't set up for parents to be there in the classroom. A lot of parents aren't comfortable to be there, and they don't feel qualified to be there, but teachers can also play an improved role in finding activities that they can do with parents. As soon as that happens, I think parents are going to be able to customize the school experience in a way that they value and participate in a process that improves their family life as well. So I would really try and encourage not parents but schools as well to look for creative ways to join the classroom and the family life somehow.
Okay. I was actually going to go in a different direction, but I think that this is an interesting enough topic that I'll spend my 30 seconds on it as well. I think that at the end of the day, all of the things that we're talking about here, about parents being more involved, being the first teacher of their kids, all of those things are important. But in many ways, it will only translate into the traditional classroom setting if teachers become more informed consumers of that process. They have to understand the lingo that teachers will use. Sometimes that lingo will be used to inform and enlighten, and sometimes it will be used to isolate and keep a barrier between the teachers and the parents. They have to become more comfortable with understanding what they expect from the school to in the first place. It can't just be kind of off-the-cuff thinking. You have to kind of think about what you want the schools to do in order to hold them accountable for doing those things. So I think that there's definitely a niche out there for people who can help parents become more informed consumers about what education should be happening within education. So at this point, that's my little 2 cents, and I'll finish the podcast right here. I want to thank before I thank Simon and Daniel, I'd like to just make again let everybody know that we appreciate everybody who has decided to follow us, and to let you know that if you have thoughts on anything we've talked about or possible topics for shows or those kinds of things, you can reach us at thebackoftheclass@yahoo.com. And that's it. Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you, Daniel.
It's always a pleasure.
All right. Take it easy.